Support for Living on Earth comes from listeners like you. Please make a gift online at loe.org or call 800-893-3377 right now. And thanks.
It's Living on Earth. I'm Bruce Gellerman. Elizabeth Windsor has some interesting pictures in her home. That would be Windsor Castle, where the Royal Library contains her collection of amazing rare things, which happens to be the title of a book edited by Sir David Attenborough, who was knighted by Queen Elizabeth. His book, Amazing Rare Things, The Art of Natural History in the Age of Discovery, chronicles how 15th century artists depicted the strange and unusual specimens adventurers found in the New World. Living on Earth, Steve Kerwood spoke to Sir David about how the book came about.
Well, the Royal Collection has a gallery attached to it and regularly shows things from the collection. There's a great wealth of natural history drawings in the collection, and it was decided to do a selection from there. And I was invited to help in selecting the pictures and selecting the artists, which was, of course, an extraordinary privilege. I mean, to riffle through, if I may put it that way, riffle through drawings by Leonardo da Vinci is quite a privilege.
Indeed. In fact, those horse studies, I mean, to look inside the mind of an artist and see how he was doing the studies.
Yes, I mean, artist is an inadequate word, really, for Leonardo da Vinci. I mean, it's an accurate word, of course, but Leonardo's curiosity into how things worked is just mind-blowing. And the details, and of course the sheer beauty of the drawings, is absolutely extraordinary.
Leonardo, the quintessential, perhaps the definitional Renaissance man. In your book, Sir David, you quote something that he wrote around 1490 that shows that he was even formulating a Gaia hypothesis. Could you read from that for us, please?
Well, Leonardo wrote, "Just as man is composed of earth, water, air, and fire, so this body of the earth is similar. Whereas man has bones within himself, the supports and framework of the flesh, the world has rocks, the supports of the earth. If man has within him the lake of blood, wherein the lungs expand and contract in breathing, the body of earth has its ocean, which also expands and contracts every 6 hours with the breathing of the world. As from the said lake of blood arise the veins, which spread their branches through the human body, likewise the ocean fills the body of the earth with an infinite number of veins of water."
So indeed, a vision that the earth is an organism, the Gaia hypothesis, just like a human. And we get this from Leonardo da Vinci in 1490.
90, that's correct.
Today's environmentalists should move over for a moment.
But it's a remarkable vision, isn't it? And it shows such understanding of both the earth and the body.
Perhaps one could say of the people who are in your book that they're all, at the same time, artists, scientists. And perhaps that's what, due to the time, that if you were going to tell the story of the things that you were observing, that you would need to have the pictorial representation, and there was no one else to do it but yourself.
Yes, but some weren't even scientists. I mean, it's quite remarkable how you actually have to know how something works before you can draw it accurately. And that's a very interesting little problem. I mean, there's a drawing from a man called Cassiano del Pozzo. He commissioned artists to draw these things. And the artist was faced with, for example, a sloth, or maybe you call it a sloth. But it, as you well know, it spends its life hanging upside down. Now, you couldn't possibly know that it spends its life upside down if you'd just been sent the skin, unless you really understood the mechanics of the thing. And they looked at this and they naturally drew it as though it was standing horizontally, but in a normal sort of way, with its feet beneath it. And the result is, I mean, to our eye, of course, grossly unnatural, almost comic, because it doesn't work that way. So you really have to understand about these creatures before you can draw them accurately.
One of the most interesting characters that I'd never heard of before I read your book was this woman who went to Suriname. Can you tell me her story, please?
Yes, Sibylla Merian was her name. She was a widow, and she earned her living selling insect specimens in Holland. And in the mid-50s, she decided that she'd like to go and see many of these specimens that she had been selling and draw them in the wild. And so off she hopped with her daughter to Suriname. And there she collected caterpillars and watched them as they metamorphosed into the adult insects, not knowing what they were going to turn into, and produced, as a result of this, some magnificent plates, which subsequently became very famous indeed. And very beautiful they are too. You can certainly tell a Marion drawing. She has a deep affection for curls. I mean, she can't resist a curl.
So what was her intended audience? For these early artists of nature, who was expected to look at their works?
Well, book buyers. There have been always people ever since the invention of printing who buy books for the beauty of their plates. And what more beautiful subject can you have than animals and plants? And Marion, as I said, earned her living by selling insects, by insect specimens. But her books became very highly treasured and very sumptuously produced, too, so that she made her living by selling her books.
Now, in your book, only a couple of the artists that you have here ever traveled outside of Europe to go visit some of these far-flung places like Indonesia or Suriname. How did the other artists get access to some of the animals and plants that they painted?
They were sent back to Europe from Roman times onwards. I mean, the Romans imported animals from Africa, sometimes to slaughter in the Colosseum, but sometimes because they were really strange things. In the 16th century, a rhinoceros was imported into Europe, and Albrecht Dürer, the great German artist, drew pictures of this, which circulated around the whole of Europe because the image of this extraordinary armoured creature was so remarkable. And, of course, there was a huge flood from the 16th century onwards with the discovery of the New World. New creatures being brought in all the time, and people with their, you can almost see their jaws sagging as yet another extraordinary animal is unloaded from one of the ships.
I have to say that looking at the work of some of these early natural history artists, I see a lot of abnormal or monstrous forms of creatures, or dragons, of course, and deformed pieces of fruit. What's the appeal in seeking out these monsters in nature?
Well, you see, it's not unusual for us. We too think in biology that things that are abnormal, there is something to be learned from them. And there's also something exciting, which is something rare. I mean, today people are fascinated by white tigers, for example. They think, my goodness, how extremely interesting they must be, because how rare they must be. Now, biologically, one knows perfectly well that that is a very simple genetic change which produces an albino, and these are albino animals, and that albinism can be transmitted from one generation to the next. So we today still have this fascination with the rare and the odd. And, of course, in a more superstitious age, a lot of people thought that some of these things were signs from the gods. And indeed, today, there are parts of the world where people will tell you that they've seen a deformed root, some Christian symbol or other.
Sir David, you've made a number of nature films, including, well, most recently, the stunning series Planet Earth. And thank you so much. It's a tremendous gift, your work.
Thank you.
So tell me, to what extent do you feel that pull to the exotic, to the unknown, in some of the work that you do?
Oh, I think all of us are drawn to seeing the unusual. I mean, it's exciting to see the unusual, and it's very nice to think that maybe you were the first person ever to see something.
Tell me perhaps something that you have seen for the first time. Maybe it was in a remote place. Tell me the story.
I'm fascinated by birds of paradise. I have been since I was a kid. Don't ask me why. Well, yes, you can ask me why, because I can
why?
Tell you, because they're well, thank you very much. Because they are unfailingly beautiful and extraordinary and unpredictable and in many cases unimaginable. I mean, there are 42 different species of them, and they have amazing feather decorations, which the males display in courtship dances of great elaboration. And they live in a very, very remote part of the world, that is to say, central New Guinea. And there are still species that have never been filmed in performing their courtship dances.
Sir David, before you go, could you tell us perhaps an illuminating or perhaps your most exciting travel story from all these many places you've visited all these years?
Well, 50 years of doing it, it's difficult to choose. But let me revert to birds of paradise. There was a particular bird of paradise I was wanting to see, and it displays on the ground. It's a remarkable bird which clears a space, an arena, on the floor of the jungle, of the rainforest, removing with great care every little tiny twig, every little bit of dead leaf until the ground is absolutely clear. And then in the early dawn, it dances. The male turns up at this, calls to the female, the females assemble, and then the male performs this amazing dance, displaying his plumes to the females. Most of the time, at the end of the dance, the females will look at him and just fly off and think, and you can hear them say, you know, if that's the best you've got, forget it. But if he's lucky, you see, he's going to be okay. Anyway, we spent a long time looking for this, and at the end of 6 weeks, we found an arena. And it was on the edge, on the top of a ridge, in a very wet part of the rainforest of Western Irian, of Western New Guinea. And we set up a hide that night, and I decided that in the morning we had two hides, one side on each side of the arena. And the cameraman was going to go into one and I went into the other. And we decided that we wouldn't take a sound recordist. I would do what I could there, but also we would have an electronic system of talking, me talking to the cameraman, so that he could hear what I said and I did. And we were whispering. And the bird came down and it did its dance and I was just simply thrilled to the marrow. And then the bird finished and flew away. And the cameraman and I scrambled down this very steep side of the ridge towards our camp. And as we came down, the recordist who had left in the camp, the sound recordist, came out and waved. And I yelled back and I said, "We got it! We got it!" And the recordist said, "I knew the precise moment that you saw it, because through that microphone which was on your chest, the radio microphone, I could hear your heartbeat, and it suddenly doubled its speed." And that's the reaction which one seeks to create in viewers looking at television programmes of the natural world. And in many ways, that's the reaction that I'm sure these artists who are in this book hoped to create in those who came to look at their drawings.
Sir David Attenborough's new book is called Amazing Rare Things, The Art of Natural History in the Age of Discovery. Thank you so much, Sir David.
It's a pleasure.
Sir David Attenborough spoke with Living on Earth's executive producer, Steve Curwood.